Welcome to the Badlands, that overlooked place where philosophical thought runs into the political concerns of the day. Welcome to the Badlands Politics and Philosophy Podcast, a series which aims to expose and examine the underlying ideas that shape our political landscape. I'm Toby Napolitano.
And I'm Michael Hughes. On the last episode, we started talking about the ideological split between centrist Democrats and progressives on the issue of money in politics. Democrats, as we noted, tend to be less concerned with the effects of big money in politics, while for progressives, it's a central area of concern.
And we explained why progressives think the issue is so important. In short, it undermines our democracy by ensuring that politicians and ideas that favor the interests of the wealthy have a leg up on their competition.
This means that for the majority of Americans, their interests don't get represented, and they also have greatly diminished influence over political outcomes. And the vast gulf between public opinion and policy on many important issues provides compelling evidence of this.
Now, commonly, when people are discussing money in politics, the focus concerns the effects it has on individual politicians. The idea that they're receiving big donations from individuals or businesses will have a corrupting influence on them, and thus make them more likely to favor those individuals or businesses over the interests of the majority of their constituents.
But, as we explained last episode, even if there wasn't any corruption at all of this kind, money in politics would be a huge problem because of how it skews the outcomes of our political processes in favor of those who represent the interests of the wealthy.
We also argued that this is, in fact, morally problematic because it leads to worse outcomes for the non-wealthy majority and because it undermines our ideals of civic equality.
We think that the structural problems of money in politics are enough to justify progressives' concerns over politicians taking big donations. To only focus on individual corruption is to miss the bigger problem. But all of that being said, we really need to talk about individual corruption. Are we really supposed to believe that receiving big donations has no effect on politicians?
I feel like the right response here has just got to be, come on, really? It seems like most Americans these days don't think that politicians are particularly trustworthy, and so I don't think that most people need an argument for thinking that introducing huge sums of money into the equation probably makes things worse. But we should take the issue seriously because centrist Democrats apparently don't think there's a reason to worry about corruption.
And in principle, they can still agree with everything we've said about the structural problems of money in politics and argue that since they are looking out for the interests of the non-wealthy majority, and since they are impervious to corruption, it's okay for them to take money.
So let's now give some reasons for thinking that individual corruption is actually a serious problem, over and above all the structural problems we've pointed out. The first thing to note is how the individual corruption problem is framed.
Consider, for instance, how Hillary Clinton framed the issue during the 2016 primaries.
There is this attack that he is putting forth, which really comes down to, you know, anybody who ever took donations or speaking fees from any interest group has to be bought. And I just absolutely reject that, Senator.
Hillary Clinton takes it that what progressives assume is that anyone who takes donations or speaking fees has to be bought. So the question, as Clinton apparently sees it, is whether receiving big donations means that someone has to be bought.
Saying that someone is bought in this context would basically imply that they are just political stand-ins for their donors, and that politicians who receive big donations are, in effect, the servants of those donors. So to call someone bought is to really strongly impugn their character, since it would basically mean that they are just lying through their teeth on the campaign trail when they promise to represent the interests of the voters.
So one aspect of the way the issue is usually framed is that it implies an attack on someone's character, and this is clearly how the Clinton campaign interpreted the criticism from Sanders. But the other aspect is the idea that if someone receives donations, they have to be bought, or as Michael Blake puts it, that they are automatically corrupt.
I think we have to take a step back, first of all. You know, if the question is if you believe money automatically corrupts someone, because I think that's the core, deeper issue that's there, which I'm not convinced of that, you know, just because of the dollars that comes in that automatically corrupts someone. Absolutely not.
In other words, it seems as though the progressive thinks that there can't be exceptions, that it's impossible to receive big donations and still be well-intentioned.
But obviously this is a straw man. Of course there could be exceptions, and of course it's not assumed that taking donations means one is therefore acting in bad faith. The relevant question, for the progressive, is whether taking big donations makes one more likely to promote the interests of the donors than they otherwise would be. Once again, the question is whether the presence of big money in politics skews things in favor of the interests of the wealthy.
And once again, we don't even need to assume that anyone's character is corrupted or that they're acting in bad faith. People can be influenced by big money even if they are generally well-intentioned, and we'll explain why in a moment. Though once again, we shouldn't pretend like politicians have a wonderful track record of even being well-intentioned. Politicians often do have corrupt characters, and it would be incredibly naive to ignore that obvious fact.
Right. Arguably, the history of organized human society is just a history of the abuse of power. Or at least, that is certainly one of the dominant themes.
Of course, there have been plenty of very well-intentioned political leaders throughout history and in the US, but there's a reason the very term politician carries connotations of deceitfulness, hunger for power, and corruption. And so we don't think we need to convince many people that at least some politicians do have corrupt characters, and that huge donations are a problem at least for those politicians.
But let's once again assume, for the sake of argument, that the relevant Democrats are well-intentioned and of sound character. What reasons do we have for thinking that accepting big donations makes one more likely to favor the interests of the wealthy?
Well, first, there are just plenty of cases where a politician stakes out a position on some issue, then they receive big donations from some industry, and their position changes completely in favor of that industry. These kinds of cases constitute pretty strong evidence that receiving donations can sway one's opinion one way or another.
Take, for instance, Howard Dean's evolving views on corporate tax rates. Back in 2004, when he was a supposed liberal firebrand, angling to become the Democratic presidential nominee, he used to sound like this when talking about corporate tax rates.
Is lay out a plan to balance the budget and include some sort of plan to increase corporate taxes, just as Joe Lieberman has suggested, because corporate taxes are now at the lowest level since 1934, which means the rest of us are paying the rest of the tax burden, and that's not fair.
But then, fast forward to 2013, after he started taking large sums of money from huge corporations for basically performing the functions of a lobbyist on their behalf, and then he started to sound more and more like this.
To reform the tax code, we have a corporate tax that doesn't work. It should be lower, but it should be paid for simply by removing things like the oil depletion allowance and all the loopholes that have been put in over 70 years. The reason it should be lower, I realize that many progressives are clutching their chest as they say this, but we really do have to repatriate some of the many billions of dollars that are being held overseas by American corporations. So we need to lower it, but we need to make the corporations pay for that simply by taking out all the exemptions, which is bad for business anyway.
Now, what could have possibly led to Dean's change of heart? Was it that the corporate tax rates increased dramatically from 2004 to 2013? Not according to the Tax Policy Center, nor any other source we could find. The corporate tax rates have actually been pretty constant for the past 20 years.
The only notable difference seems to be that Dean didn't used to take huge sums of money from big pharma and energy companies. Of course, we can't say with absolute certainty that his relationship to these megacorps led to this shift in his thinking, but it certainly seems like a salient factor.
Possibly the most famous case of this in the last few years comes out of a conversation between Elizabeth Warren and Bill Moyers, where Warren explains how Hillary Clinton's dependency on financial support from Wall Street led her to reverse positions on a bankruptcy bill that was originally sponsored by the credit card industry.
These cases are hard to explain without appealing to the fact that they received big donations from the relevant industries.
Second, it's clear from what the big donors say that they expect politicians to give their interests special weight. For instance, here's a clip of Stephen Klubeck, former chairman and CEO of Diamond Resorts International and a major donor for the Democratic Party, warning Democrats that he will cut off their money if they keep talking about the millionaires and billionaires and how they skew the system.
So is it the right message that the Democrats are going with?
It's so effing wrong.
Whoa.
I've talked to Schumer. I've talked to Wyden. I've talked to Pelosi.
And said what?
And I said, if you use the term billionaires again, I'm done.
And I've made it very clear, I'll cut your money off. And others will do the same.
When he is asked about how the Democratic Party leadership has responded to his concerns, he says,
so when you tell the Democratic leadership this, when you meet with Wyden and Pelosi and Schumer, what do they say to you?
Well, so far, they've given me great signals that they're willing to participate and get there. We shall see.
Of course, this is not proof that the Democratic Party will go one way or the other, but it's striking, again, that Kubek has the expectation that they will go his way. It's hard to see why he would have that expectation unless he's had a history of having substantial influence.
And even if they don't ultimately do what Kubek wants, it's striking that he has their ear in the first place. If Steven has a problem with what they're doing and he wants to talk about it, Democratic Party leaders are listening.
Right. And what happens if any of the rest of us have a problem with Democratic Party leadership? Well, we can send an email or try to call their office, but odds are we are not going to get any response.
And if we do, we don't actually expect our leaders to take our concerns seriously. We expect that they'll offer us some trite platitudes and assure us that they're doing everything that they can to address whatever our concern might be.
Think about this for a moment. What do us ordinary citizens have to do if we want to be taken seriously by our representatives? We have to organize. We have to get lots and lots of people to express their concerns or dissatisfaction on some issue. Then, and only then, will our concern be taken seriously. Meanwhile, if Kubek himself is perturbed by the Democratic messaging, then he can go straight to the party leadership, express his concerns, and be taken very seriously.
And why is that? Well, politicians generally are pretty interested in keeping their jobs. And the fact is that if the super-rich donors like Kubek withhold their donations, then Democrats will have a much harder time funding their re-election campaigns. And as we discussed last episode, the more funding you have, the more likely you are to win.
For the rest of us, organizing is effective because if lots of people are dissatisfied with the representative, they will not only not vote to re-elect the representative, but they might help campaign against that representative in various ways. In other words, they will make it less likely that the representative will keep their job.
But think about what this means. Because wealthy individuals like Kubek matter so much more for the success of a political campaign than a non-wealthy individual, us non-wealthy folk need to organize a huge group of people to even approximate the influence that Kubek has.
Right. This makes it abundantly obvious that the non-wealthy, as individuals, have only a tiny fraction of the political influence that the wealthy have.
And again, we don't have to suppose that the relevant politicians have corrupted characters or are acting in bad faith. They might have really noble intentions to promote the general well-being of their constituents, but the problem is that because big donations are so important to their ability to carry out those intentions, it's rational for them to give much greater weight to the wishes of their donors.
Right. Being corrupted in the sense of being influenced by big donations does not require having a corrupted character or intentionally acting against the interests of the people you are supposed to represent. This is a case where structural facts about our political processes explain how big donations have a major influence over the activities of politicians. Because of how campaign finance works, even those politicians who want to represent the interests of the non-wealthy majority have good reason to actually give priority to the interests of their wealthy donors.
Okay, on to the third piece of evidence for thinking that donations influence politicians, and this is a big one. There's good psychological evidence to think that, generally, giving gifts is an effective way to influence people's opinions. Some striking instances of this phenomenon have been studied in medicine, which, incidentally, is a field where we expect practitioners to uphold the highest standards of objectivity. There's a growing body of research studying the effects that receiving gifts from pharmaceutical companies has on doctors' prescribing habits. The basic trend is pretty clear. The more gifts doctors receive, the more they prescribe pricey name brand drugs over their generic alternatives.
In a 2013 Georgetown study, for example, the researchers found that for doctors in their study who received more than $500 in gifts a year, the average cost of their prescriptions was $189. Those who received less than $500 in gifts a year wrote prescriptions that cost on average $114 per prescription. That is no small difference.
My favorite study on this phenomenon, though, is a 2009 study that appeared in the Archive of Internal Medicine. In the Georgetown study we just mentioned, the gifts were substantial: meals, cash, and ownership interests. But in the 2009 study, the researchers looked at the effects of receiving really trivial gifts like mugs and pens that were branded with the logo of a particular drug. What they found was that med students who received these small branded gifts formed more favorable opinions of the drugs that were advertised on the mugs and pens.
The results of that study are somewhat comical, but of course the findings of this research have serious consequences for people. And again, We use these medical examples in particular because people tend to see doctors as being especially objective and trustworthy parties. One might think that if anyone is immune to the effects of gift-giving, it ought to be doctors, and maybe scientists more generally, since they have training that should safeguard them from those sorts of effects. But what our best science tells us is that humans are generally pretty vulnerable creatures when it comes to practical decision-making, no matter who they are. And if the effect shows up strongly for doctors, what does this tell us about politicians, who don't have such a sterling reputation?
So there are just facts about human psychology that no politician is going to be able to escape that make them more likely to support the interests of their donors. This doesn't mean their character is corrupt, but just that they're human. But this is really important, right? Because often Democrats will say, we shouldn't assume that receiving donations corrupts, we need strong evidence. The point is that, provided the politicians in question are human beings, it would be pretty damn shocking if they weren't corrupted. If anything, the burden of proof ought to be on the person who is receiving big donations to explain how it is that they've avoided being influenced.
And given what we said earlier, we ought to keep in mind that, unlike doctors, politicians are often dependent on big donations to run their campaigns and keep their offices. If that fact doesn't further subtly endear the donors to politicians, that would again be very surprising.
To our minds, this presents a pretty strong case for thinking that individual corruption is a problem, and that, in general, it would be very surprising, though not impossible, to find a politician who takes big donations who is not influenced by them. At the very least, the burden of proof ought to be on the person who is defending the practice of taking those donations.
This means that Democrats can't reasonably frame the issue the way they have tended to do so. In order to think that they're taking big donations isn't a problem, we would really need substantial evidence that they were employing all sorts of measures to ensure that they were free from all of the sources of influence that we've discussed. We don't need to prove that Democrats are not exceptions to the rule when it comes to the problems of big money in politics. They need to prove that they are the exception to the rule. And frankly, that would be a very tough case to make.
At this point, we've talked quite a bit about how money and power corrupt individual politicians, but we don't want to give the impression that we think the problem is one-dimensional. Just as there's the potential for politicians to be influenced by big donors who they depend on for funding, there's also potential for important nonprofit and civic organizations, organizations dedicated to important public causes, to be influenced by politicians and their political networks of big donors, which those organizations rely upon.
How this could impact the ways that civic organizations engage is pretty simple. Start with a national civic organization that requires a substantial amount of money to be able to pursue its civic goals and to have national reach.
And now consider whether wealthy donors are likely to contribute when those civic organizations challenge and critique the politicians and the legislative agendas that the donors have lined up behind.
On top of that, some politicians are in a position to dictate donor activity and potentially weaken an organization's ability to engage in effective national political campaigns.
There's an obvious potential for this dynamic to lead to the self-silencing of civic organizations, based on the rational fear that critiquing the existing political power structures and bad political actors will come at too high a price, namely, that politicians will see that their donors cut their funding.
This is precisely the calculus that James Rucker, co-founder of The Color of Change, describes black leaders having to go through whenever they consider criticizing the Clintons or the big players in the D.C. power structure more generally.
You know, when I was running Color of Change, different era, you know, I saw up close the way things worked. And I'll tell you now, right, for me, right, I do, you know, I'm on the board of different progressive organizations. I work with a lot of folks. I have friends that are in the Hillary camp and in the Bernie camp. And I've had to think about, okay, just like I had to think about then, okay, what are the costs for me saying certain things? And I'll tell you, you know, to talk about Hillary in the ways that I'm talking, there's a cost to it. You know, I want organizations that I'm a part of to be supported by donors. There are donors who do not like this.
The impact of such silencing is obviously difficult to calculate, and that's at least part of what makes it so enduring. That's because the silencing fits a familiar pattern of oppression. When an oppressor forces a victim to self-inflict wounds to avoid some even greater harm, it's extremely difficult, if not impossible, to establish blame.
And in this case, since the harms are the absence of political speech and the absence of certain facts and ideas from mainstream political discussions, it is no surprise this form of political corruption goes almost entirely under the radar of mainstream political commentators.
And yet, despite how difficult it is to identify cases where civic organizations are silenced by the potential funding blowback that their political speech might incur, Rucker is able to provide some clear-cut cases.
So if you look at, for instance, the Congressional Black Caucus, you've got a good set, I mean, you've got a breadth of members here, but you've got some very progressive members who have a very progressive agenda, who are right on point on race. And you'll see some of those folks not, you know, they're standing back. They're not endorsing Clinton. They're not going to endorse Bernie. They're just going to kind of keep their powder dry, if you will, because should they, and there's very few, but should they come out and say support an opponent of the Clintons, you know, they could be screwing themselves.
Okay. So civic organizations have to speak in ways that endear themselves to politicians in power who might function as imperfect allies. And sometimes this means holding back criticisms of those allies. So what? Why is this so problematic?
Well, again, how problematic you think this is depends on the moral lens through which you view contemporary American politics. And this again gets back to the fundamental division between centrist Democrats and progressives.
Centrist Democrats tend to be content with the political establishment and the rate of progress. Progressives, on the other hand, think that we are failing to achieve sufficient progress on a variety of extremely important social justice issues, and think that a more radical critique of our existing power structures is desperately needed.
Moreover, we think that our civic organizations have an important role to play in helping to raise the national consciousness about social justice issues and to lead the call to action, and particularly to exert pressure on the political establishment to pursue social justice even when it isn't politically and or personally expedient to do so.
And yet, due to the funding relationship between civic organizations and the political establishment, their capacity to perform these civic functions is limited. Progressive organizations that have the funding to speak on an issue and reach a national audience risk losing their voice altogether if they make powerful critiques that effectively challenge the political establishment and the status quo. Progressives find this catch-22 deeply problematic and think this funding dynamic needs to be resisted whenever possible.
At least to some extent, we think this explains why progressives were far more concerned about the influence the Clinton Foundation allows the Clintons to exert. It provides them with a mechanism to influence the national discussion on social justice issues.
Once this argument is made clear, we would hope that this might be an area where centrists and progressives can find some common ground. Even if we have staunch disagreements on significant moral and social justice issues, we should all be able to agree that we don't want a small network of people having so much power to control narratives around social justice work.
Okay, so we've explained in some detail why money in politics is a problem, how our political landscape is skewed in favor of the wealthy, and why this is harmful. But there's one important nagging question, and that is the practical question. Even if big donations corrupt politicians, and even if, generally, money in politics undermines democracy, don't Democrats need to take big donations to win elections? Even if progressives don't particularly care for most Democrats, they tend to prefer them over their Republican counterparts. So if they want to avoid the worst outcomes, shouldn't they support the taking of big donations, or at least not oppose Democrats who do take those donations? Barney Frank makes this point nicely here.
No, I get big donations from banks. I don't believe that people on the left should engage in unilateral disarmament. Is it really your goal to have us all lose? Do you think it would really be better for liberals, regulators, if all the money from the banks went to Republicans as opposed to just 80%? Because we could accomplish that. We could refuse to accept any.
This is often the predicament for progressives. Not only are they faced with a choice, as they see it, between two bad options, but furthermore, they have to ignore the fact that the less bad option takes big donations. This means that, in effect, the progressive, in order to avoid the worst outcomes, has to participate in the undermining of democracy as they see it. Progressives end up having to choose between potential disaster or sacrificing their deep political values.
There are two assumptions built in here. First, that progressives should support Democrats. And second, that to win, Democrats need to take big donations.
Let's focus on the second assumption first. Is it true that Democrats need to take big donations to win elections? Well, that is certainly the conventional wisdom. As we've stressed, you certainly need to raise lots of money. And as we've also stressed, it's easier to do this if you can solicit and take big donations.
The obvious outlier here is Bernie Sanders' 2016 campaign. it was the centerpiece of the campaign that he didn't take any big donations, and that the average donation was $27. The Sanders campaign was able to raise huge sums of money on the basis of the grassroots support that it had, so that it was even able to outraise the Clinton campaign at various points and stay competitive in the primary.
The hope for progressives is that the Sanders campaign will set the blueprint for how progressive candidates can raise money without taking big donations. We will return to that hope shortly, but first we should ask, does the Sanders campaign show that Democrats don't need to take big donations to be successful against Republicans?
Actually, we think the answer here is no. We should ask ourselves, if moderate Democrats like Hillary Clinton decided to forego big donations and focus on small grassroots contributions, would they raise more money than they currently do? Probably not. Her campaign just didn't have the same grassroots excitement that the Sanders campaign had.
Now, why not? Well, the progressive line of thought on this matter is simply that her platform lacked progressive policies which, while they are not well respected in Congress, are actually quite popular among the electorate. The electorate is very critical of establishment politics, and so overwhelmingly agrees that, for instance, money in politics is a huge problem. The Democratic Party, very often these days, is perceived as the party of the elites, which shouldn't be terribly surprising given their connection to big business interests, and given what we've said about money in politics. This is not to say that the Republican Party is any less a party of the elites, but let's put that issue aside for this episode.
If this is right, though, the thought is that while progressives might have a shot at winning elections without taking big donations, centrist Democrats might not. So it might be true that most Democrats, anyways, need to take big donations to have a shot.
Now, could an otherwise centrist Democrat just take a strong stand on campaign finance reform and forego big donations for their election and then succeed? Maybe. But the relevant question is just whether a centrist Democrat could take that kind of stand on campaign finance and still be a centrist Democrat.
This isn't merely a matter of definitions. The question is whether generally centrist thinking can be reconciled with the underlying progressive principles from which it follows that money in politics is a huge problem. If one accepts the kinds of arguments we've put forward about the problems of money in politics, then our guess is that one ends up with a political worldview that is pretty distant from centrist democratic thought.
If progressives are right in thinking that the Democratic Party largely represents the interests of their wealthy donors, then it's not clear how you could support serious campaign finance reform that would effectively cut off the direct access and influence those donors have with politicians.
Right. To support that kind of campaign finance reform is just to reject the whole structure that props up much of the Democratic Party. And so it's no wonder that the party's often hostile to progressives who run as Democrats and bring attention to the problems associated with big money in politics.
To sum up, then, it might be that in many cases, progressives should support Democrats against their Republican opponents, even if the Democrat takes big donations. Assuming, of course, the Democrat is the better option, which won't always be the case. However, and this is a big however, what progressives are banking on is that the Sanders campaign demonstrated how progressive candidates can run successfully in major campaigns. The idea that progressives should support Democrats only has force when there aren't viable progressive alternatives.
The real question for progressives, then, is whether other progressive candidates can replicate the Sanders model. And we certainly don't have the answer to this question. But there is some cause for cautious optimism. Since the Sanders campaign, there's been a real outburst of grassroots organizing, which is focusing on running progressive candidates in progressive-style campaigns. Progressive groups like Justice Democrats and Brand New Congress have had some success in using the Sanders model and generating significant interest and money for various elections all over the country.
Now, it remains to be seen how much electoral success these groups will have. If they fail, then Barney Frank might be right. We should not try to require Democrats to avoid taking big contributions unless their Republican opponents also stop doing so.
But here's where the progressive has some firmer ground to stand on. Even if it's true that Democrats need to take big donations to succeed, that's no reason for thinking money in politics isn't a huge problem. Nor are progressives wrong for thinking that any morally decent platform will prioritize limiting the role of money in politics.
And in fact, since most Americans think that campaign finance is really broken, and that money corrupts politicians, it ought to be a popular proposal to adopt. After all, it was one of the things that clearly provided a lot of energy to Bernie's campaign. So one thought might be that what progressives should do is just push Democrats as much as they can to make issues surrounding money in politics a focus of their platform.
But it's not quite that easy. After all, if real campaign finance reform is so popular, why don't Democrats take a stronger stand here? Well, we should think back to the Stephen Klubeck quote. Would Democrats continue to get their big donations that they need if they took a strong stand on campaign finance, which limited these big donations? I'm guessing Stephen would think that that kind of campaign finance reform is just so effing wrong.
In other words, not only might taking a strong stand against big money in politics be ideologically incompatible with centrist thinking, but it might be practically incompatible with it as well. A good deal of the success of the Democratic Party rests on being able to take big donations. And a prerequisite for being able to do that is making sure that the millionaires and billionaires continue to have special influence.
This is somewhat of a disconcerting conclusion, as it would suggest, as many progressives have been saying all along, that trying to get progressive change from within the Democratic Party might be hopeless. If the party's very survival depends on Democrats taking big donations, then it's easy to see why that might be the case.
So that, anyways, is our take on the debate between progressives and Democrats on the issue of money in politics.
And, of course, there's lots more to say about the issue of money in politics in terms of both underlying philosophical principles and in terms of the actual effects that money in politics has on our democracy.
I mean, for God's sake, we made it through two whole episodes of Money in Politics and haven't yet mentioned Citizens United.
True, but our aims in these first two episodes were somewhat modest. What we wanted to argue, first and foremost, is that the problems with money's role in politics go much deeper than how they're typically framed by centrist Democrats and in political discourse more generally.
Right. Specifically, we wanted to emphasize that money isn't problematic in politics just because of personal corruption and pay-to-play. Our political institutions are structured in a way that, through selection bias effects, the wealthy have vastly more power to influence political outcomes.
And these structural problems are at the center of core moral disagreements between progressives and centrist Democrats over what it takes to achieve civic equality and to address the harms caused by income inequality and poverty more generally. Ultimately, if there's going to be any reconciliation on the left, then there are going to have to be many frank conversations about the moral foundations that ground critiques of money and power.
And then there's the problem of corrupting influence of money on politicians themselves. Too often, Democrats brush this concern aside as being groundless and not warranting serious discussion.
While it's one thing to argue that taking big donations is, however unfortunate, necessary to have any political success, it's disingenuous, or at least stupendously naive, to think that any politician will be completely impervious to the influence of receiving big donations. That idea goes against everything we know about politicians, campaign finance, and human beings.
In any case, we hope to have at least started to lay out some of the important issues related to money and politics. And we'll hopefully find time to circle back around to these issues in later episodes.
At the very least, we'll continue to address the consequences of money's role in politics in the next episode, where we'll shift our focus to the economy, and in particular on the moral problems related to wealth and income inequality. But that's next time. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Badlands Politics and Philosophy Podcast. If you're enjoying the podcast, you can help it grow by subscribing and by giving it a good rating or a review. And don't forget to check out our website, badlandsphilosophy.com, where you can find a list of citations for every episode and access written content that we post there regularly. This week, we'll have a piece up that I wrote called Why We Shouldn't Talk About Criminals When We Talk About Criminal Justice, where I discuss one of the ways the term criminal gets misused in popular discourse. So again, if you're interested, you should check that out on our website, badlandsphilosophy.com. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do that through our website, and you can also find us on Twitter at @thebadlandspod. Thanks again for listening.